This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this month, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Elizabeth Warren joined us for the annual New Yorker Festival. It was, for reasons you know only too well, a virtual festival. And with the 2020 election just weeks away, the state of American democracy was and is on everybody's mind. Here's Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking with Andrew Marantz of The New Yorker.
I'm just going to get right to it. This isn't, you know, a time for small talk. This is a pretty perilous moment in our history. So I think we should just start right with it. We obviously have a health crisis, an economic crisis as a result of that, a reckoning over racial justice in this country. And on top of all that, we have a democratic legitimacy crisis. When we've come this far in terms of breaking of norms and seeing all these abnormal signs that our democracy is in peril and that this administration seems to have authoritarian impulses, what are you looking for as more red flags as we move toward this election? What are you looking for in the coming weeks that will tell you that we have really crossed an irreversible line? And what can you both do as members of Congress to try to safeguard what we have left of our democracy? I guess, Senator, we can start with you on this.
Well, I don't think it's about the red lines in the next 24 days. How long have we got now? We know that Donald Trump's going to do every single thing possible to steal this election, to hang on to power, to deny its legitimacy. There's not any surprise coming in that sense. There may be particular details, but come on. We know this man by now. He has told us who he is. So for me, it's about what are we doing about it and doing about it now. And that is, we got to get people out to vote. Our big chance here is November 3rd. We can't afford to beat Donald Trump by a little bit. We got to beat Donald Trump by a huge amount. And that's how we reassert the strength of democracy. Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm not looking for any red flags because he's already thrown out plenty. One of the most extremely troubling things that the president has done recently is really signaling that he will not clearly commit to a peaceful transition of power. And so the thing that we have to do, our first line of defense, is absolutely to overwhelm at the polls, and to overwhelm at the polls in every way possible. To overwhelm in early voting, early in-person voting, mail-in voting, and overwhelming on day of election results.
Right. And so is there like a break glass in case of emergency plan? If you start to see a state of emergency getting called in a swing state and people getting shut out from polling places or some massive irregularity, what are you going to do? Do you go to the well of the Senate and have a sit-in? Like, what is your plan? And also, what is our plan as citizens? Do we show up somewhere in March? Do we start stockpiling food? Like, what do we start doing?
Well, I think one of the things that's extremely important is that we have to remember that in our democracy, and yes, I'm going to use the word democracy, contrary to Senator Mike Lee, we, the people, have power. We always have power. And I think it's extremely important that people be ready for mass civil demonstration, nonviolent, of course. But we have to make sure that we have a demonstration on the scale of the Women's March in 2017, even larger than that, or on the scale of everything that we saw this year. There need to be immediate political, popular, and social consequences for leadership that refuses to adhere to the rule of law. And we've seen this administration scale back on very disturbing developments due to public backlash and due to popular support or lack thereof. And so I do think it's still important for people to understand that if Donald Trump refuses to acknowledge the results of this election, that we exercise our First Amendment rights. And then for us as elected leaders, as elected officials, depending on those developments, there are provisions in the Constitution in making sure that whether we address this in the House or that we also turn out for critical House seats so that we win over state delegations, that we make sure that we have all the pieces in play for every eventuality.
Let's say Joe Biden gets in cleanly, peacefully. Let's say Democrats take the House, Biden administration, Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate. Right. So that's the hypothetical. In that world, you now hear people talking in this, especially this post RBG moment. You hear people talking about a whole wish list of stuff. You hear people saying expanding the courts, term limits for justices, getting rid of the filibuster, national popular vote, reinstating the Voting Rights Act, statehood for DC, Puerto Rico, maybe even Guam. Is anything on this list something that you're not down with? Are you okay with all those things? And what do you prioritize? And how do you get there under a Biden administration and a Democratic Congress?
Well, first, right off the boat, I will say that I am not supportive of blanket statehood for Puerto Rico. I've actually introduced a bill with Nidia Velasquez for a self-determination process, and one that is binding, just, and not influenced by outside interests. The issue of DC statehood and Puerto Rico statehood are two very, very different issues. Puerto Rico was a colony and is a colony, and it's a spoil of war. And the United States has been an imperial force in that colonial dynamic. And so the way we approach colonized entities is a process of self-determination and decolonization. DC statehood is an issue of just criminal disenfranchisement. And so that's one distinction that that I would put in there. Joe Biden is a fan of Puerto Rico statehood. That's one small difference. Well, it's a big difference to Puerto Ricans, but it is a difference that we have. But the rest of the agenda, I'm game for us to talk about. In terms of priorities, I think it's important for us to really examine the structural power. And one, I mean, I'm not in this body, so maybe I'm speaking out of turn. This is more Elizabeth's turf, but she has led on discussions of the filibuster. And I think we really need to be examining these tools that allow structural imbalances of power that that fuel minority rule to be really, really examined and see if they're actually what is best for our country on a structural democratic integrity level.
Yeah. I ran for president on changing the filibuster. I think that's an important part of what we have to do. But think about it this way. When we're talking about the list, I don't want to dismiss the importance of, we're going to take over, I hope. And this COVID crisis, at least on the current trajectory, is still going to be a serious problem. It is powerfully important that we get the COVID crisis under control and be able to reopen the economy. It is also important that we not walk past the importance of racial justice and addressing this issue. And every chance I get, I want to be sure that we elevate this and we make sure it stays a continuing part of our conversation.
Yeah. On this issue of bipartisanship, I think people are very confused in this moment because on the one hand, it seems clearer and clearer that there isn't always a good faith negotiating partner on the other side of the aisle when it comes to so many of these issues. There aren't two sides to them, and yet they are presented as if they have two sides. Does this mean that there is no such thing as bipartisanship, right? You still hear people talking, the fever will break. One day our friends on the other side of the aisle will return to us. They'll have an epiphany. You often hear the Democratic nominee talking in these ways. And it sounds to some people just so outmoded. I mean, does that strike you as hollow? Or what can we do with bipartisanship as a concept?
Look, my view on this right now is we need to hold people accountable. and the Republican senators, I'll speak to the side of the House that I'm on, the Republican senators have enabled Donald Trump. They, when Donald Trump says he just may not follow the results of the election unless he gets elected, where have they been? When Donald Trump plays footsie with Russia, where have they been? When Donald Trump says he is going to try to overturn the Affordable Care Act, but he has this secret magic health plan that no one knows what it is, where have they been? When Donald Trump calls people in Richmond who are white supremacists fine people, and when he refuses at the first presidential debate to denounce white supremacy, where have they been? We don't start this by saying, oh, it's all about bipartisan and you get to do half of what you want and we get to do half of what we want. No, this is about responsibility. You want to be a United States senator? You have to be willing to speak up and stand up for the Constitution of the United States, for our democracy, and for the health and safety, not just of a handful of people, but the health and safety of all Americans. That's where we start. And this election, November 3rd, is going to be about exactly that. Voters need to hold their senators accountable for what they've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is an area where just there's also just a huge generational shift in our politics. Bipartisanship to young people seems like this kind of vintage fantasy. Like, it seems like people are yearning for this time that I've never lived through. But for young people, bipartisanship got us the Iraq War. Bipartisanship got us endless war. Bipartisanship got us bank bailouts. And we very rarely see the results of bipartisanship yielding in racial justice, yielding in economic justice for working families, yielding in improvements to healthcare. And in fact, the things that have yielded those things have been Democratic majorities. I hope one day we can get to a point where our democracy is much more healthy. But what we are seeing right now is that when the Republican Party is given the keys to any governing body, it will yield an abuse of power, fealty to Trump or any other authoritarian that would try to assume the highest office of the land. And, you know, I think that what we really need to examine perhaps is common ground on an issue-to-issue basis. This is not to say that I've never worked with a Republican in my life. There are some areas where we've been able to reach out with more libertarian elements of the Republican Party. There are some areas, but I don't necessarily think bipartisanship for bipartisanship's sake is a virtue. But just because something's bipartisan doesn't mean that it's good or that it's good for you.
Thank you both so much. This was great.
Thank you.
That's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking at the New Yorker Festival this month with staff writer Andrew Marantz. Now, we've got a lot more coming up this hour. Dexter Filkins is going to be reporting on the critical swing state of Florida. And I'm very excited to be talking later with Elvis Costello. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We're going to take a look now at the essential battleground state of Florida. With 29 electoral votes, it's the largest of the swing states, and by some analyses, Florida is the key to the whole presidential race.
Florida is like America. It's big, diverse, and idiosyncratic. It's also voted with the winner of every presidential election, except for two, since 1936.
Staff writer Dexter Filkins is a Florida native, and he's been reporting on the electoral battle that's taking place there. In 2016, Donald Trump won the state by just over 100,000 votes.
Elections in Florida are almost always won by a narrow margin, and the state has a long history of voting problems and voter suppression. This year in Florida, there have been a number of major shifts in the electorate which could shape the outcome. Demographic changes, a big increase in mail-in voting, and a fight over the voting rights of felons.
Dexter has talked with a lot of people about what those changes mean and how they may determine the winner of the state's electoral vote. First up here is the longtime U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, a Democrat, who lost his bid for re-election in 2018.
Okay, Senator Nelson, we've seen over the years that the margins in statewide races in Florida, including often the races for the presidency, are often so narrow. What makes Florida so complicated to win?
Well, Florida is like the country because the country has moved to Florida. You think about it. South Florida is, particularly in Miami-Dade County, Hispanic. Move on up into Palm Beach County, and you've got the Northeast has moved there. Go over to the Southwest Coast, Sarasota on down to Naples. You've got the Midwest of the U.S. has moved there. Go up to North Florida, and they talk with a very flat accent as the Old South. And by the way, I found that as an elected official over 40-plus years, that my accent could actually change which part of Florida I was in.
In terms of demographics, the demographics of Florida, who's Biden strong with, and where is Trump strong? And if you look at the two candidates, who are they failing to capture in Florida?
Well, there are two significant changes that have occurred, which is those 65 age and older. And this is a demographic that has traditionally been going to Republicans. But that demographic has changed for Joe. And I believe that it probably is because of the underscoring of the coronavirus, the serious nature of how this has been botched by the current administration. And so that's one component of the electorate. The other one that's changing is that we don't know yet, but it appears that younger people are going to vote in much larger percentages. And if that's the case, that's a vote that should go to Joe instead of to the incumbent president.
If you were running Joe Biden's campaign right now, what would you be doing? What would you be focused on in Florida?
Well, the coalition that will elect Joe this year in Florida will be strong out of the urban counties. And of course, because Joe Biden is a political moderate, he will have a lot better chance at swing counties across the middle section. Drive out a big vote in South Florida in the three big counties there, and then make inroads into North Florida with the African-American community and neutralize the huge Republican vote that will surround in the more rural counties surrounding Jacksonville.
When you look ahead to Election Day, we're in the middle of a pandemic. What's it going to look like?
For the first time ever, by Election Day, at least half of the electorate will already have voted. Voted by mail or early vote. What's going to happen uniquely in Florida? Because 22 days out from the election, the mail-in ballots are being processed to double-check the names, the signatures against the signature on file, so that presumably all of those mail-in ballots are ready to go ahead and put in the machine at 7 p.m. on election night. And so you will not only get the processing of the day of the election ballots, but the ballots that have been already cast previously. And it could be that you have the early results tilting to Biden, and then it's starting to narrow as the evening goes into the next day.
But there's a lot that can go wrong on Election Day in Florida.
Ion Sancho is a retired election supervisor from Leon County, which includes Florida's capital, Tallahassee. He's been very active in trying to maintain the integrity of the electoral process.
Ion, it seems that the driving premise of the Republican playbook is lower turnout. Like, lower turnout elects Republicans, higher turnouts elect Democrats. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Unlike the Republican legislatures across the board who are not approving vote-by-mail drop boxes, the Florida legislature, they were planning on utilizing vote-by-mail as the primary method to harvest Republican votes. So they went ahead and passed a law saying that every early voting site in the state had to have a vote-by-mail drop box. That was before President Trump changed the playbook on them and decided to attack vote-by-mail, really threatening a number of elected officials' campaigns who were Republican here in the state. And they squawked about it mightily and got Trump to sort of give Florida a pass.
One of the things that people have talked about is with this kind of deluge of mail-in ballots that we're going to have, is that you're going to have lots of signatures that will be challenged, will come under challenge. Are you worried that that process could get out of control?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Because as I witnessed personally in the 2000 election, when we were doing the canvassing of the signatures of the voters, party representatives would be in the canvassing room. And depending upon the political affiliation of the voter, would lodge a challenge, which would immediately slow the process down. That's the worrisome point. I'm hoping that we can have a number of representatives of the media at the various canvassing boards, which often does not occur. And Florida has an open counting process. As soon as the polls close or the last voter has voted, the citizens are allowed to be in that polling precinct and actually watch what the staff is doing in terms of closing it down, printing out the final results. All those eyes on the process will help the process be better. Basically, from my point of view, secrecy only helps two categories of individuals, those who are corrupt and those who are inept.
One issue which came up repeatedly in my reporting on Florida is Amendment 4, which was intended to be the largest enfranchisement of voters since 1971. Amendment 4 was approved by Florida's voters in 2018 and said that all but the most violent felons, once they had served their sentences, had the right to vote. That could have meant nearly 800,000 new voters in Florida this November. But then the Republican-controlled legislature stepped in and passed a law dictating that ex-felons could vote only if they first paid all the fines, restitution, and fees imposed at their sentencing.
Victor, hey!
Betty!
Hey, how you doing?
Good, it's great to see you kind of in person.
Yeah, kind of.
Betty Riddle is one of those former felons. She grew up in a segregated neighborhood in Sarasota, Florida. At a young age, she became addicted to crack cocaine and was convicted of 5 felonies. But then she turned her life around, and today she works for the Sarasota County Public Defender's Office.
You were able to vote because of the passage of Amendment 4 to the Florida Constitution, which was approved by, I think, 60% of Florida's voters. What was your reaction when that passed? How did you feel?
When I first heard it, I was like the first one in my office to walk down to register to vote. So it was amazing. Me and my family celebrated, you know. It was a victory.
I mean, I'm just curious, but did you feel like having been to prison that it was over?
It was free. I was free. I was free from the chains. I had no chains because you don't know as when you become a convicted felon and being released from prison, you finish one sentence and start another one. So, you know, that becomes your lifestyle. You never think about voting because you know you're not entitled until that day came.
you cast your first ballot. The Florida legislature voted to require that all convicted felons, even after they've served their sentences, have to pay all their fines, restitution, and fees that were imposed at the time of their sentencing. And that, as you know, that's effectively taken, you know, several hundred thousand potential voters are not going to be able to vote now. What do you make of that law?
First of all, I was really upset because at the beginning, I knew it was a poll tax. I already knew it wasn't about court costs or fines, because when they did impose that on us, they knew that it would affect all the low income people. And they knew that we couldn't afford to pay that before this election. They knew that. They didn't want to see it, but that's pretty much what it is. We're paying to vote. No one else is paying court costs and fines to vote. But we as felonies, we have to pay to vote. That's what we're doing. I never thought it was about the money. I always believed in my heart that it was about stopping us from voting. Always.
Why don't they want you to vote?
Okay, I think they passed a law to keep us from voting Democrat.
Have you been in touch with other people who were in prison or convicted of felonies who are also planning to vote or having problems, or like what are people saying?
Yes, like every Saturday I join a couple of organizations that I go up from 12 to 4 and I go door to door service asking people, have they registered to vote, do they owe court costs and fines? And a lot of them gave up. After that bill passed last year, a lot of them gave up because they didn't want to challenge politics. They just say they're going to win. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends and people just returning from prison. I lost a lot of them after that because I had them when it first passed. So, you know, lately I've been crying out to the young generations to stand on our behalf, so the ones that really can't afford to vote and stand for us and vote. I've been reaching out to a lot of young kids through my grandkids, and I think that we have a chance of reaching more people between now and the day to vote. I really do, and that's what I'm going to do.
Latino voters are going to be 17% of the electorate in Florida on November 3rd, and therefore a potentially decisive group in determining the outcome. I called my colleague Stefania Taladrid, who has been looking at the complexities of Latino politics in Florida. And Steph, I know we can't talk about the Latino vote in Florida as anything remotely monolithic, but how decisive is it?
The way you win Florida is by winning the Latino vote. And I know the media pays no service to this just because we ourselves call it the Latino vote. But, you know, what does that mean? And in Florida, I think there's been a lot of focus on Cuban Americans because, you know, they have a great deal of political power in the state. But there's a huge diaspora of Puerto Ricans, and even Ecuadorians, Nicaraguans, Mexicans, Peruvians. And so actually that's something that can benefit Biden, because I think it's fair to say that the Cuban American vote is largely lost to Trump at this point, but that's not the case among Puerto Ricans and some of the other diasporas that I mentioned. That's really, you know, Biden has an opportunity among those communities to really improve his standing among Latinos here.
So Steph, what's Biden doing to kind of get the support of the Latin community, and whether that's Cuban or Puerto Rican or Brazilian or Argentine or Ecuadorian? What's he doing?
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of it is TV and radio, too. I mean, you turn on the radio here, at least in Miami, and chances are you will come across a Biden ad. Most of them are in Spanish, of course. But it's not just about the ads. They have a pretty robust campaign apparatus here, and they're holding events pretty much, you know, every day. Just for the vice presidential debate, they had a drive-in watch party. They're also holding caravans. They call them caravanas con Biden. And so, again, going back to this idea of how important the diasporas are, you have Cubanos con Biden holding the caravanas. You have Puerto Ricans, Boricuas con Biden holding the caravanas. And these are just long caravans of anywhere between hundreds to 1,000 cars driving around the city, just showing their support for the candidate.
You mentioned the Biden ads, and I'm just wondering, are they good?
Yeah, I mean, the ads are really, really good. And as you know, the Republican Party has really focused on the Red Scare, right? On really portraying Biden as this puppet of the far left who will usher communism into the country and bring in very radical policies, right? And the Biden campaign has actually responded to those kinds of negative ads with their own. And there's one in particular in which they compare Trump to a caudillo-like figure, you know, a Latin American strongman like Chavez, like Castro. And it's actually a notion that's resonating with a lot of people, because in conversations with Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, and even some Cubans, they tell me, you know, when I see Trump, I see a Daniel Ortega type of figure. You know, when I hear him criminalizing protesters, when I hear him criminalizing the press, I recognize those profoundly authoritarian instincts.
And Steph, you know, every 4 years we hear about the sleeping giant that the Latino vote is in the United States, and it hasn't always materialized. And I just wonder, is this the year when its full effect will finally come into view?
I don't have an answer for that yet. But, you know, this year, for the first time in this country's history, Latinos are the largest minority voting group, right? So there's tremendous, tremendous, tremendous power behind their votes. And I surely hope that they'll exercise it.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer, and he spoke with Stefania Teledrede, also of The New Yorker. And we heard from former Senator Bill Nelson, Ayan Sancho, and Betty Riddle. You can find Dexter's reporting on Florida and a great deal more at newyorker.com. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When rock and roll emerged in the days of Little Richard and Chuck Berry, Elvis and the Beatles, no one thought about long careers, the way a musician's work might evolve over time. But that was then. Now there are careers that are 40, 50 years long. Elvis Costello has been on the scene since the mid-70s, a leader of the new wave. But since then, he's led a vital and brilliant career of experiment and variation. And I've been following it all along.
Tell me, how does it feel in the hour of deception, in the moment of pretend?
Costello's newest album, Hey Clock Face, is out this month, and it was largely recorded before the pandemic. I spoke with him as he sat outside his house near the harbor in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is why you might even hear a foghorn in the background. I wonder how you approach new music like that, if you feel that a new album must have either a new sound, a new thematic approach. How do you approach that idea of a new record?
Well, I about 2010, I told people I was going to concentrate on live performance. I think that was coming to terms with the fact that the model that we had lived by for the previous years was no longer in existence. That was, you made a record and then you went out on the road and you played the music of that album folded into your general repertoire. That sometime around then, maybe it was the way the record world itself was changing, that stopped happening. And so I put my work into first the revival of the Spectacular Spinning Songbook, because it put all of my songs in play and left them to chance, literally. Then I was completing this book I'd been working on for a long time. I started to feel as if everything was about using what you had and adding into it, and you could change the focus. You were no longer worried about, oh, I got to play the hit single, you know?
Although on the other hand, even the casual Elvis Costello listener, not the committed fan, has 34 albums that you can sample and move around in.
Yeah. I'm completely at ease with the balance between the old and the new. There's another way of looking at streaming is it's radio with all the unpleasant talking taken out. You know, and it's not...
Don't put me out of business here.
And it's not an advertising man's idea of what the playlist should be. It's the listener's idea of what the playlist should be in the most cases.
Well, when you've recorded a new album and you talk about the story of an album, how do you view the story of Hey Clock Face? Hey Clock Face, the title track is deriving from Fats Waller. It's deriving from, you're nobody's nostalgist, but you're drawing on a musical history. You're writing about time, which seems to be a big theme in this record.
Well, let me start at the top. I mean, it was distinctly an outlandish adventure one cannot imagine now. It began with me leaving early for a tour in Britain and getting on a plane and flying, you know, do you remember that? Flying to Helsinki, somewhere where I literally don't know anybody. They don't know me so well. I found a little studio there that intrigued me. I went in there with the songs in my head rather than in any kind of demo form. I knew the nature of those particular songs. They needed to be brought to life in a moment and not worked at. I couldn't rehearse them with my band. I just had to start playing. And that approach freed me. Like, they literally came into existence in the moment I made them. And I had a young engineer who was very, very adept at the modern era of digital editing, which allowed me to do things that, you know, would have been impossible. So I would disagree that you can't get music of feeling and drive out of this technology. I went from there after 3 days to Paris. And here's another unimaginable scene for you. 30 people gathered in an apartment in Paris celebrating Steve Naive, my piano player of 43 years, you know, my colleague, my friend, celebrating both his birthday and receiving his French passport. A group of people kissing each other and eating cake off each other's plate, raising their glasses and singing La Marseillaise. I mean, can you imagine the danger we were in, you know?
Is the idea to get the existing music that's in your head down on wax, as it were, or is the idea to give them an idea and then go from there?
No, I mean, I knew how these songs should feel, and obviously I had no way of knowing that combination of instrumentalists would be quite as vivid as the recordings from Paris turned out to be. We then went and did a tour of England, you know, with the Impostors. We opened up in Liverpool in the dance hall where my mother used to dance when she was a young woman in the late 40s. She was at the gig. She's 92.
Hey, clock face, keep your fingers on the dial. You stole those precious moments and the kisses from her smile. And now I'm living in these hours where we were wild. I'm not wasting any more time.
And then, you know, the second week of the tour, you start to see those empty seats when we know that every ticket in the house is sold. And it was by the time we played London, I just had to admit that I'm putting my crew, most of all my crew, really, because they do all the close handling work, my crew, my band, and the audience in some kind of harm's way.
This must be killing you. This must be killing you and your wife, who are performing musicians, who bring so much joy to people who are in the seats hearing things live.
Well, you know, I
be sitting on your porch.
We came into the wings at the Hammersmith Apollo, and I knew in my heart, I hadn't told anybody, but I knew in my heart there probably wasn't going to be another show on that tour. I slept on that feeling and made the decision the next day because the Canadian border was about to be shut and I knew I had to get home to my family. But, you know, I came into the wings and I said, okay, guys, you know, we better make this one count. We're going to end with peace, love, and understanding as we often do. But let's play Hurry Down Doomsday, The Bugs Are Taken Over, which we hardly ever play.
The man in the corner of this which is a sinister purpose. Temple of the Railroad Kings.
And, you know, I could see people in the front row go, oh, yeah, you think you're very funny, don't you? You know, but they knew why we were doing it, because at that point we were trying to chase away shadows. Useless things, but I can't bring myself to love. You know, a week later, the Prime Minister was in the ICU, so it didn't sound so comical then, you know. But nobody knew.
How do you feel about how do you envision the future? When do you think that you're back? I mean, you don't have any more of a beat on the news than anybody else, but for a musician, it's got to be different.
I suddenly realized that I hadn't spent, you know, this now at this point, I've never spent this amount of uninterrupted time with my 13-year-old sons since they were 3 months old. We are sharing every day. It's beautiful. We, you know, I can't complain about that. But, you know, our work, our livelihood does require us to go and play shows. So there is a wishful pencil mark in the diary of next year, and we'll see where we are when we get there. Yeah.
Elvis, some years ago, Nick Baumgarten spent a lot of time with you for a profile in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And the subject came up of character, a character that a musician might play, especially in his or her youth. And you said this, even people who we take to be the real deal did it. They made up a character for themselves, and you had to have an act. There's some artistry attributed to rock and roll where it's supposed to be more authentic than show business. I don't really hold to that. Now, we all, those of us of a certain age, remember you, we're about the same age, as a certain kind of figure who exploded onto the music scene, and both visually as well as musically, and projected a certain character, a certain temperament, as well as the music itself. How do you view that now?
Well, I was 22 when I made my first record, you know, so if there hadn't been some changes made by now, there would be something badly wrong, you know.
Yeah.
You also never ask a doctor, like, if you have something wrong with you, and you go, doctor, I've got this problem with my hip, like, before you operate on me, can I just ask you how you felt about your vocation in medicine when you were a medical student? Whoever asked that of a doctor, they never ask it. They only ask it of artists to somehow, because there's this implication that you've betrayed some sacred trust. You know, things you say in interviews when you're 23 are not catechism that you have to repeat for the rest of your life. There's some things more often said to get somebody off your back. I've never had a master plan, but I think
when I was a little kid, rock and roll was a new thing. There was no such thing as long careers.
No, it was supposed to be this juvenile delinquent music. And frankly, I didn't know anything about rock and roll when I was a kid, because my parents listened to Dizzy Gillespie and Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and Nat Cole and Stan Kenton and heaven knows what else, you know, Duke Ellington. They didn't care about rock and roll. That was kind of crude. And I'm kind of with him on some of that, apart from Little Richard.
Now, your father was a singer. He was a trumpet player. Uh-huh. And we've got a track from the group that he played with, Joe Lawson, the orchestra. And let's listen to him singing At Last in 1969.
Oh, wow.
At last, my love has come along. Like a song.
You know, my dad started out, he and my mother ran clubs in that same, you know, almost evangelical way when there's a new style of music arriving from overseas on records, which were very scarce and expensive and difficult to get. My father went and mother both went to London in the early 50s, and my dad played around the jazz scene. And guess when I came along, he did what a lot of jazz musicians realize is necessary. He got a job that paid better as a singer. So then he was in a commercial dance band, and that's how he came to sing this song associated with Glenn Miller. Not that when he's singing At Last there, it has no reference to Etta James. That was a cover. That is a note-for-note transcription of the Glenn Miller recording of At Last.
Well, we also dug up one of the earliest recordings of you, mm-hmm. where you're singing backup vocals for your dad. It's the theme music for a soda company, but I think it's called Secret Lemonade Drinker.
It's wonderful. Yeah. We're doing the background voices on it. It was my first paid recording session. Yeah.
I'm a secret lemonade drinker.
Oh, it's Always. I'm not trying to give it up, but it's one of those nights.
Always. Always.
Always lemonade. I'm a secret lemonade drinker.
Always. Always.
Always lemonade.
That's not bad at all.
Well, here's the weird thing, isn't it, about the Elvis name, is my dad is affecting this Elvis inflection.
Exactly.
He's a very good mimic, and he could do comic mimicry like that. And that's why I had such a rich record collection, because every week you would get given a stack of Hit Parade singles, because this dance band just played the Hit Parade. It's hard for Americans to understand, but we didn't have the 24-hour pop radio that you all had. And everything was decoded through a series of other interpretations. So you would hear these very bizarre versions of, you know, the Four Tops or The Who, played by a Glenn Miller style swing band with a guy who was, you know, a really elderly guy who was like 35. You know, my dad was about 35 when he was doing this. You know, it seemed really weird, but that was the way I saw music first. I would go to the dance hall with him on a Saturday afternoon. I'd go to the radio broadcast when school schedule would allow it, which was get there at 8 in the morning and watch a bunch of musicians smoke cigarettes and scratch themselves until it was time to go on the BBC and play an hour-long show with guest singers. And those guest singers could be anybody from the Hollies to Engelbert Humperdinck. But it was a glimpse, and it took away some of the mystique, but it also, it made me realize this strange exchange between the mundanity of the workaday job and the magic when the light went on.
Elvis, you've done a new project called 50 Songs for 50 Days, and these are political songs, a lot of them. What role does music play in politics for you?
I never think of it as political in the sense, because I don't have a manifesto and I don't have a slogan. Other than I might have the title of the song, but I try to avoid the simplistic slogan nature, you know, of in songs. I try to always look for the angle that somebody else isn't covering, because there's other people doing the other thing really well. It's the same with the heartfelt love song, you know? The heartfelt love song is something that other people can carry off. From the get-go, I always thought, well, maybe that's not my job. I don't have the matinee idol looks to carry off that, so maybe I'll go the other way, and that's what I did. And with this, I think of it like an installation. That's the way I referred to it, like you would do an art installation. It's not supposed to do anything other, I said in the note that I put up with it, you know, console, amuse, or irritate. I'll take any of those reactions. But the simplest thing to say about it is the things that we are so rightly enraged about, we see as unjust, we see dividing us, we see summoning up like almost like a madness of passion. It's all happened before, and here are the songs to prove it. Most of those examples of a lot of the same issues. Did you honestly think you'd be talking to, I don't know, you know, I didn't think I'd be talking with my 13-year-old sons about a lynching in 2020. Those are the same things that I was hearing reported on the news at their age in England, that very BBC, you know, terrible sort of outrageous happened in Mississippi today, you know, and sort of, I never thought I'd be any of that. But it isn't even sadly about that one event or what transpired since. It's what, how do you get there and how do you keep getting there? And that's where songs come in, because they remind you, we keep getting there, you know? And on this, say, this new record, there's a song called We're All Cowards Now. The name of the song is not You're All Cowards Now. The name of the song is We. I'm including myself in that. Because, you know, it takes, let's face it, it takes a lot more courage to love than it does to hate. It just does.
Elvis Costello, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking
to you. It has been a pleasure talking with you, David, as always. You stay well and of good heart.
You too. You too. And you give me so many years and so much pleasure and so many varieties. I just can't begin to tell you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elvis Costello, his new record, Hey Clock Face, is out this month. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much for joining us today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Danny Bonner, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.